Hello. So, as surely as we belong to the universe, we belong together. We join here to transcend the isolated self, to reconnect, to know ourselves, to be at home, here on Earth, under the stars, linked with each other. Welcome. For those of you who are here for the first time, we are a liberal religious tradition that seeks wisdom from all the world's sources of knowledge, including science and nature, reason and intuition, and the world's religions. We welcome everyone regardless of specific beliefs, politics, race, class, or sexual orientation. We are a UU welcoming congregation and are intentionally inclusive of LGBTQIA. Okay, so I just want to give a few announcements before we get into the main part of the service. I want to remind people that Jim Scott is going to be speaking on April 14th. He's going to be giving a concert at 7 o'clock. That's a Saturday. There'll be a potluck preceding that at 6 o'clock. There's a sliding scale of $10 to $20 per person for adults, and children under 12 are free. I also wanted to remind folks that we'll be having an Easter brunch potluck next Sunday after the service, and then also an Easter egg hunt. So be sure to bring a dish for that and come have fun. May I ask Emily Fraser to come forward to light the chalice? Joy and grief, health and sickness, light and darkness, peace and anger, life and death, wholeness and brokenness, tranquility and disturbance, winter and spring. We each bring all of these here to the sanctuary of unity and diversity. For this 1 hour of this one day, and pour them out, commingling the oil of our lives to become the flame of this chalice, the symbol of our shared living tradition. I invite you to stand if you are willing and able in body or spirit and sing our opening hymn number 312, Here on the Path of Every Day. I'd like to invite all the youth or young at heart to come up to the front with Emily as she shares with us When the Wind Stops.
Good morning.
Hi, everybody.
How are you feeling this morning? What do you think of this weather we've got today? It's a little gray and gloomy, right?
Yeah. Well, we've got a story we're reading today called When the Wind Stops. And it deals with things like the weather we have today. Good times, bad times, good things, bad things. What happens? Where does it go? Does anything ever stop, or does it just keep going somewhere else? Let's see what this story has to say to us about that today. Yeah, she does. Look at that. It's blowing in the wind. It looks like it's about as long as her own body. Wow, that's some long hair. All right. So The story begins like this. The great, bright, yellow sun had shone all day, and now the day was coming to an end. The light in the sky changed from blue to pink to a strange, dusky purple, and the sun sank lower into the long, glowing clouds. The little boy was sorry to see the day end. He and his friend had played in the garden, and when they were tired of playing, they lay down in the grass and felt the sun on them, warm and soft, like a sleepy cat resting. There had been icy lemonade in the afternoon, which they drank under the pear tree, and the little boy's father read him a story on the porch before he went to bed. Now his mother came to say goodnight. "Why does the day have to end?" he asked her. "So night can begin," she said. "Look." She pointed out the window, where high in the darkening sky, behind the branches of the pear tree, the little boy could see a pale sliver of moon. "That's the night beginning," his mother said, resting her hand on his shoulder. "The night with the moon and stars and darkness for you to dream in." "But where does the sun go when the day ends?" the little boy asked. "The day doesn't end," said his mother. "It begins somewhere else. The sun will be shining there when night begins here. Nothing ends." "Nothing?" the little boy asked. "Nothing," his mother said. "It begins in another place, or in a different way."
"Like on the other side of the world?"
"Exactly, like on the other side of the world." Yeah. The little boy lay in bed, and his mother sat beside him. "Where does the wind go when it stops?" he asked. "It blows away to make trees dance somewhere else." "Where does the dandelion fluff go when it blows away?" "It carries the seed of new dandelions to someone's lawn." "Well, where does the mountain go after the top?" "Well, down to where it becomes the valley." "Where do waves go when they break on the sand?" "Sucked back to the sea into new waves." "Where does the rain go when the storm is over?" "Into clouds to make other storms." "And where do clouds go when they move across the sky?" "Yep, to make shade somewhere else." "And the leaves in the forest, when they turn color and fall?" "Into the ground to become part of new trees and new leaves." "But when the leaves fall, that is the end of something," the little boy said. "It is the end of autumn." "Yes," his mother said, "the end of autumn is when the winter begins." "And the end of winter?" the little boy asked. "The end of winter, when the snow melts and the birds come back, is the beginning of spring," his mother said. "Yeah." The little boy smiled. "It really does go on and on," he said. "Nothing ends." He looked out at the sky. The sun was gone completely. The lovely pink clouds had disappeared. The sky was dark and purple black. High above the branches of the pear tree shone clearly now, a thin new moon. "Today is over," his mother said. "It's time for sleep. And tomorrow morning when you wake, the moon will be beginning a night far away, and the sun will be here to begin a new day." The end. Thank you for sharing this story with me. You can now go ahead back.
Learn in love and
So as Emily comes around to pass out the baskets and collect your joys and concerns, we know that our financial contributions to this congregation come from sacrifice and hard work. We are so grateful to this and commit together to ensure the funds we gather collectively do a greater good for ourselves and our world than they could have done alone. May you give as you are able and willing.
The joys and sorrows of our lives build the connections and links that form our community. And many of us, how many of you yesterday were out at the March for Our Lives? Do you see that group? Most of the people who are here today, and there are people here today certainly feeling inspired by the marches for gun control. There was great turnout and energy in Manhattan and around the country and the world. We can make a difference. On a much more mundane note, but important to us here in this little congregation, someone here is happy that the electrical outlet in the Alsop room has been updated so that the coffee and water for tea no longer trip the breaker. So thank you to Mark Mayfield and the facilities manager. Elka Lawrence has a personal joy today that her son and daughter-in-law, Thomas and Mary Champion, are expecting their third child in September. And Michael Oldfather tells us that finally his surgery is scheduled for tomorrow. I added the finally. And so unless you're tired of sending good wishes his way, he would welcome more. And our last great celebration is that Ruth Friedman is celebrating her 92nd birthday today. And she brought birthday cake to share with all of you after the service. So please join her in celebrating her first birthday on Palm Sunday. We hold all of these joys and concerns in our hearts and minds and honor those that you keep in your own hearts.
This is a poem titled The Winter Rain by Wendell Berry, who is an American novelist, poet, and environmental activist. The Winter Rain. The leveling of the water, its increase, the gathering of many into much. In the cold dusk, I stop midway of the creek, listening as it passes downward loud over the rocks, under the sound of the rain striking. Nowhere any sound but the water. The dead weed stems soaked with it, the ground soaked, the earth overflowing. And having waded all the way across, I look back and see there, on the water, the still sky.
I invite you to stand if you are willing or able in body or spirit and sing hymn number 57, All Beautiful, The March of Days.
Equinox this past week, I can't help but recognize the connection of our monthly theme, balance, with the equinox. We reach that moment of balance, equality between light and dark, and we pass it, ready for the light to grow and increase until June, when it will again wane. The balance of the seasons, shifting yet predictable, solid, steady, reliable. However, spring in this part of the country is anything but solid, steady, and reliable. And given the snowstorms out east, maybe it's not just this part of the country. But here, every year, the weather seems to fluctuate in wild ways. Spring brings more than a shift in the patterns of light and darkness and growing warmth to welcome new plant life emerging. Each day we have a little more sunlight, heating the surface a little bit longer, and the angle of the sun slowly shifts so the sunlight's more direct. Warm air rises and form clouds as it cools, like in the story. And our particular climate here in the middle of the continent is complicated by the cold, dry air from the north meeting the moist, wet air from the Gulf and the warm, dry air from the southwest, and bang! All those different temperatures produce instability.
Ice and water in the top of the clouds collide, producing ions and lightning sparks between them, and the superheated air of the lightning cools, producing a vacuum. And as the air rapidly expands and contracts, we hear a crack, and then the echoes and reverberations that give us the rumble of thunder. And sometimes, more often than we'd like, the instability and wind shear and changing wind directions, usually ahead of a cold front and low pressure system, yield a full-blown tornado. The U.S. gets more tornadoes than any place in the world, and here we probably get more of them in the U.S. than most places. And that's why we're known for Dorothy Gale from The Wizard of Oz. Spring in Kansas and Oklahoma, where I come from, means storms. Sometimes violent thunderstorms with tornadoes and general drama. So, the balance of spring may not be as simple as third-grade earth science made it look. And that's true for our lives, too. If balance at regular times can be tough, getting the kids to school and sports and music lessons, putting in the hours that work requires, finding time for the garden or keeping up with friends, keeping the house up enough that it's at least safe and healthy, trying to carve out time to be a good citizen and fellowship member, making sure meals are served fairly regularly, and you pretty much keep it together, and then there comes something that throws it off. The thunder of an ill child or parent. The lightning strike of conflict at work or in the family. The tornado of job loss or crisis of confidence, the storms of life with suffering and death and mortality blowing us, drowning us, tormenting us. When we can't rely on whatever our lives have felt to be reliable, how do we keep any sort of perspective or control then when the storms of life collide with our already shaky sense of balance? Queer UU writer Mason Bolton offers these words. Good morning. I missed your good. Because a plane, because a truck, because a gun, because a cop, because a government, because of people suffering. Because too many people suffering. Because war, because famine. Because some mornings it is so hard to rise, to wake, to be a self. There is a pause here. There is a deliberate cessation. I want a cessation to the noise in my head, to the ache in the collective heart of the world. When I was young, this seemed possible. When I was young, how hope seemed to spring eternal. I want to write about butterflies, about the cracked edges of tree bark, pressing like a holy mother into palms. I want to write about the joy of children's cries, about birth, about the arch of your smile, how I could lose myself in the corners of your sweet and grinning mouth. This you is you reading this. I want for your joy, want to lose myself in you. I want your mornings good, your evenings good, all the late nights and sunrises and afternoons and moments pressed against the ticking glass of your life good. Breathe for yourself, for each other. Let us breathe in when others cannot. Let us stretch ourselves open to embrace our friends. Extend our bodies outward to anyone willing to meet us, and even those we think might not be willing. let us hold each other for the moment, for this blink of human existence. We want someone, like in the video, to hold us till the storm is over, till we wake into the light. We want to hold someone till the storm is over, till we wake into the light. Once, when I was not in a good emotional place, feeling bereft, vulnerable, fragile, I happened to be at a meeting of UU ministers, and at breakfast I sat down next to a young colleague, a man who I had watched grow into ministry over the course of years, someone I was not particularly close with, but with whom I had previously shared deep conversations about theology and our own lives, and who I found simpatico. We hadn't seen each other in some time. "How are you?" he asked. And it seemed a sincere question. "Not so good," I summoned the honesty to say. And I proceeded to fall apart, not sobbing dramatically or anything, but crying and spilling out the wounds of my heart. "I've never seen you like this," he offered calmly. He listened, we talked. And I was still not so good, but I was better from crying and talking and sharing. When storms come, you need to know when and how to take shelter. Now, that sounds easy, but it's complicated because you can't predict what type of storm will come. When I lived in Oklahoma, there was a very popular meme circulating at one time because of the varieties of weather dangers that we confronted in a short period of time. It went something like this: "Tornadoes are coming. Seek shelter in the interior of your home. Earthquakes are coming. Avoid the interior of your home. Go outside if possible. There's lightning outside. Avoid high ground. There's a flash flood warning. Avoid low ground. Hail is present. Avoid open areas. Parts of the state have received 5 inches of rain in the past 3 hours. However, a burn ban is in effect." And then there was the time that the tornado caused the escape of tigers from a wildlife refuge. And people took to calling it a tigernado. Seriously, though, I know people who almost drowned once sheltering from a tornado in a storm shelter. It would be funny if it weren't so threatening. So why do we feel the need for humor in response to such challenges, even scary challenges? Because it gives us needed perspective. When I was younger and found myself in anxious situations, I'd play the game of, what's the worst that could happen? If I don't get this paper turned in on time, I could get an F on it. If I get an F on the paper, I could flunk the course. Well, now if that's still stunned, what's the worst that could happen if I flunk the course? It'd bring my GPA down. I can live with that. Usually I could get to a worst case that I could live with. And sometimes I simply got to the absurd and laughed. Perspective. At times, though, things are more serious, and the worst that could happen is someone might die. That's the bottom line, really, isn't it? As UU minister Forrest Church used to say, religion is the human response to being alive and having to die. So religion ought to offer us some comfort or support in those times when the worst really could happen, because trouble is inevitable. It's not only death, of course. The worst may happen when we have to confront a terrible truth about ourselves. The worst may come when a friend or partner betrays us. The worst may strike when we fail in a big way and find ourselves homeless or jobless or friendless or otherwise bereft. Remember my conversation with my young ministerial colleague in hard times, I took one particular piece from that conversation that has been invaluable in gaining perspective, especially in difficult days. And I don't know whether my friend even realized he gave it to me. At one point in describing a situation in his own life, he said, "The story I tell myself about this is," and he went on to say the sort of thing that usually doesn't have that sort of a preamble that shifts the meaning of the narrative. "The story I tell myself." We all construct stories of our lives and find meaning in those stories. Most of the time we believe those stories to be true, and maybe they are, and maybe they aren't. Certainly, though, they are stories. And as people who have studied eyewitness accounts of things tell us, the human memory is extraordinarily fallible. We get details wrong. We get facts wrong. We certainly get interpretations wrong. Plus, our stories of our lives usually only draw from a single perspective, our own. The phrase, the story I tell myself, introduces enough doubt to allow one to hold the story loosely and leave room for perspective. Maybe my loved one really didn't mean those horrible words they said. Maybe I won't die if they leave me. Maybe this failure frees me to risk what it would take to succeed. Maybe I can get through the storm. Yet how often do we find ourselves in the middle of the night, anxious and unable to sleep, feeling as helpless as a tiny child crying for mom or dad? We wish a parent could comfort us, a deus ex machina could save us. We may long for some kind of a deus, some kind of a God we could count on. And many people throughout the world from different religious traditions find the idea of a God comforting, especially in tough times. They may imagine a personal God who holds them like a loving parent would. And others know a more abstract God who offers them the perspective of a God's eye view. And others, as Buddhist writer Pema Chodron puts it, finally realize that there's no babysitter that you can count on. Catholic priest Richard Rohr has reframed this God question in what is to me a useful way. He writes, "I just stumbled into love," and he capitalizes it, "I just stumbled into love again and again and was held by it." And he goes on, "This is entirely true for you too." Now, my own concept of God is very much this love that Rohr stumbles into over and over. Love is capable of holding us through the storm. It may come personified as lover or parent or child or friend. At other times, it's more abstract, but makes life worth living because I feel loved and feel the need to offer love. Now, Rohr contends that's true for you as well. I don't go so far. I know it is true for me. And though I don't think by any means that any concept of God is needed to survive the storms of life, I certainly suspect that the concept of love may be required. Certainly, it's useful. But as the saying goes, love is not enough. Chodron, the Buddhist writer I mentioned a moment ago, tells of a friend who was dying of AIDS. Now, this has to fall into the category of the worst of storms. She quotes him as saying, "I didn't want this, and I hated this, and I was terrified of this. But it turns out that this illness has been my greatest gift." What? Really? Greatest gift? He went on, "Now every moment is so precious to me. All the people in my life are so precious to me. My whole life means so much to me. He found a way to tell himself a new story, to move from the story of AIDS as the terror and the enemy to a narrative of AIDS as a gift. Now, I would call the place he came to radical acceptance of a reality that he could not change. There's great wisdom in that simple serenity prayer that theologian Reinhold Niebuhr is credited as writing and is so popular in 12-step programs. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Serenity is elusive during life's storms. We can only find it if we first acknowledge the reality of what is happening, the reality of our feelings about what is happening. When I sat down with my friend at that minister's meeting and answered him honestly about what was going on, I was not in a serene place, but I could not have gotten to serenity and acceptance without naming the realities going on in my life. This week, students from Parkland appeared on Trevor Noah's The Daily Show. I mean, they've been everywhere this week, right? They had faced an unimaginable hell. Friends dying. Their own lives threatened. Noah asked them something like, "How do you overcome what you have gone through?" And one of the young women answered, "You don't overcome it. You get through it." These young students talked about how, because they had shared this intense event, they were ready to be there for each other. Living through the unthinkable may have given them a gift of wisdom. And there's that love thing again, being there for each other. Our need to love each other is as real and strong as our need to be loved. So their living through it, their literal survival, did not stop them at the acknowledgement and acceptance of reality. They decided that though they could not bring their friends back, they could not undo that 6 minutes plus of shooting, they could have courage to make change. Sometimes we are able to make the courageous move not because of inner strength so much as desperation to do something. And at those moments when you don't know what to do, repeating Niebuhr's prayer never hurts, even if you don't believe in God. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Others may turn to the Lord's Prayer or to some other affirmation. I'll take Niebuhr as a port in my storm. Of course, all the storm recommendations, hurricane, earthquake, tornado, all of them call for advanced preparation. You have to be ready. You know the drill. Flashlights, bottled water, canned food, cash, a plan of where to meet up with the family. For the emotional storms of our lives, we can't tuck away a literal emergency kit. But maybe there are metaphorical emergency kits. We could pack in the emergency kit courage and serenity and wisdom. Or any affirmations or sayings that remind us we can make it. Another favorite of mine comes from the medieval mystic Julian of Norwich. All will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. After nearly dying herself, Julian lived as a solitary hermit in the midst of a thriving city in a time of plagues and wars that are beyond our imagining today. If she could say, all will be well, maybe it will. We might pack in our emergency kit the things that feed our particular unique souls, art or music or prayer or nature or poetry. In the kit, we have to include the people we love and who love us, even if they're far away. In some ways, we are fortunate to live in the time we do. If some sudden tragedy strikes us, we can text that loved one, "I love you," wherever they are. What strikes me as fundamental in this activation of love is how it's not really about longing to be held by that other who is comforting us. I think about those text messages that we inevitably read about in those active shooter situations. People don't text asking for love. They text sending out love. "I love you," they say. Love really is about reciprocity, the need to love others as much as the need to be loved. The 16th Gwalya Karmapa, a Tibetan Buddhist holy man who died in 1981, said, "You take it all in. You let the pain of the world teach your heart, and you turn it into compassion." So perhaps the best tool for living through tragedy and grief is compassion. Reaching out with love for others. UU Forest Church, who died of esophageal cancer in 2009, wrote in his final book, "Death is love's measure. Not only is our grief when someone dies testimony to our love, but when we ourselves die, the love we have given to others is the one thing death can't kill. The one thing death can't kill. Only our unspent love dies when we die. Love unspent because of fear." So we have choices. We have choices about how to respond to everything, even to the worst moments of our lives. Pema Chodron says, "The only time we ever know what's going on is when the rug's been pulled out and we can't find anywhere to land. We use these situations either to wake ourselves up or to put ourselves to sleep." So if we can use these situations, we all have our lists of our worst, right? The jarring whirl of adolescence certainly was part of my worst. Nearly flunking out of college as a freshman, living through the flood of 1985, a literal storm in West Virginia, and experiencing the unexpected death of my younger brother. We all have these things in our lives. You have your own list, or you will have. We do not overcome it. We live through it. We live through it with humor and perspective. We live through it by being vulnerable and real about our feelings, admitting what is going on. We call on those survival skills we've tucked into our emergency kit, and we strive to learn from the experience when we can. This very moment is the perfect teacher, says Pema Chodron. We survive and live through it most of all, I think, through love. So I wonder if we can take some time. Perhaps you have tools in your own emotional emergency kit, things that help you to live through the worst of times, and maybe you'd be willing to share some of those. And Jean has the microphone.
Sabrina Boker, there was some people don't like watching The Grave of the Fireflies, which is an anime about two kids who lived through World War II in Japan. And, of course, they die at the end, so I'm spoiler alert there. But the thing is, I watch it to reawake my compassion because it's so sad, and I want to, you know, feed the kids because they're starving. But like I said, it's one of my toolboxes to reawake my compassion is to watch that. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't recommend the kids watching it, though.
Thank you.
I'm Kathleen Oldfather, and for me, the biggest thing, the best thing in the toolbox is what's outside the window, to be in nature and to walk in nature and just to listen, and then also music, and sometimes to listen to music while I'm walking in nature. And I like bird watching. Well, one day I figured out that no wonder this works for me. I can bird watch, walk, and listen to music. And anyway, it really helps me recover during harder times.
I'm George Johnson. I don't know, one thing that I've found that has helped me is just accepting situations for what they are. I've got a couple deployments to Iraq, and there were some really dark times, some really tough times, but in reflection, I have never laughed so hard or gotten so close to people as I did in those times, and I can't look back on them as things that I regret. Life was never more real than it was then, and in a time where we spend a lot of time worrying about nonsense, it was a very real time. So I guess accepting the reality of the situation you're in and finding what joys in it you can.
I think that's one of the things that's often true of our hardest times is that they are very real.
So something, this is Kim. Something that I'm working on right now that I've become aware of recently is changing my narrative and almost retelling the story in a way that suits me a little better, because I think you're right, John and Lou, there are so many sides to our stories, and I notice when something bad is happening and I'm really tortured by it, you know, I'm really unhappy or something, my brain spirals in this poor me story, I'm a victim or whatever, and so I'm working on changing that into like maybe a way that is helpful to me, in a way that I can grow. And I read this article recently where if someone has wronged you, perhaps, which is usually what happens in these stories, perhaps you can change them into the antagonist in your story, and perhaps they have something to teach you. And so I'm trying. This is a new tool for me, is to try to spin this in a new way.
Thank you. Great suggestion.
Hi, Sybil. I'm not sure if I can express this very clearly, but I'm going to try to get the point across. Is when I hear we need tools in our toolbox to prepare for disaster. I think we have to be careful not to get in the mindset that if only we prepare enough, the disaster will not come.
No. You know,
and we haven't done our work if the disaster hits. And we didn't have the right tools in our toolbox when the disaster hits. What do we do wrong? And I think it's so important to remember that... that it's going to come. Mm-hmm. And the tools are for our recovery.
Exactly. It's for coping.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. It is inevitable. Trouble is inevitable. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I am confident on the surface about what waits for me tomorrow, but yesterday in the walk, I was walking with a woman that I don't know well, just met her fairly recently, and I said, you know, everything, every year, routine surgery goes bad, and the patient does not come out of it. Well, no, she said, that's not going to happen. You have to be, I said, well, so we had this discussion about realism and facing up to the fact that, you know, this thing is pretty close to some my lungs and my heart and, you know, a lot of things, and it could certainly go wrong. Now, what I would like to say is, if I have said or done something that you found offensive or hurtful, I hope you will remember that sometimes I didn't do that. In the case, in the event that the worst happens, so I plan to be here next Sunday, but if not, you could be thinking about me.
Well, actually, oh. Years ago, and I do mean years ago at this point in my life, I went to I think the guy was called Ira Progoff Journal Workshop. And various points in my life I've journaled, and I find that a very effective tool to deal with, especially the loss of human companionship, like when somebody dies. Back in the 80s in particular, when I lost so many friends to the AIDS virus, I journaled a lot. In more recent years, I don't journal as much as I once did, but I've always found that when I get really upset, if I sit down and write, sometimes good things come about. And, you know, sometimes they get sent off to the Manhattan Mercury and they appear as a letter to the editor. But that's how you can channel some of that energy into a constructive way. But one of my observations about American society in general is I don't think we channel well some of the emotions that are connected, especially over the loss of people. Mm-hmm. You know, I look in my own family. There's been lives destroyed when a daughter died in an accident. And the parents just never got over that. And I've often sent books, Helen Kubler-Ross, and things and said, you know, take time for yourself and find a way to turn this into something positive. And I think that that's an important thing that we have to do when you lose something as important as a home in a tornado or a child because of an accident or whatever. You really have to take that and do something to affirm life rather than just worry about it and let it eat away at you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And we can't make other people's move through their process faster. And that can be a terrible frustration too.
Susan Adamchak. Many of you know that I lost my first husband to brain cancer. It was a pretty devastating event that we lived through together. I wanted to echo, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, George, what George said about acceptance. We didn't accept that he was dying, but we were aware that that was a pretty good probability. But it was a period of intense honesty for us, in which we acknowledged our roles in our marriage, in which we acknowledged a shifting of the roles in our marriage as I became a caretaker, taking over the role that he had been very proud of and assumed very well. But it was, I don't really know what I want to say as a tool, but just we had that opportunity to be open and honest and acknowledge what we were going through. It didn't mean we accepted it, We certainly looked for treatment. We certainly hoped he would beat the odds. But we didn't stop our living during that time. And it was just, it was a time of great grace and gratitude for us. And I think trying to find the gratitude and the grace in terrible situations is another thing we need to look for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I heard you, I did hear you name some tools there, openness and honesty and also finding grace.
Hi, I'm Kathy. I think one of the things, I love getting older. I really love it to, because when you face the alternative, getting older is really, really nice. But I also think, you know, one of the things that when I was little, I was a terrible worry wart. My dad used to say, "You keep trying to carry the weight of the world on your shoulders, and don't do that." And I think one of the things that has really helped me a lot is getting to the point when I start reliving an old wrong that I've done to someone, or a regret that I have, or a big mistake that I made. I have to keep telling myself, "I can't change that. That exists. That's the past. That is real. But I can think about it all I want and whirl around, around, and around, and I'm not going to change it. What I can change is make sure I don't do it again." And that's really big, because we can spend a whole lot of time in the sea of regrets and not change a single wave. So I think that's something that has been a really important tool. And sometimes, like Christopher, I write about it and then stick it in a box and say, "Okay, I have this special place where I have some of those real regret things that are squirreled away." And so I say, "Okay, it's safe there in that drawer." And nothing there that's incriminating that my kids will find, but still.
Thank you. Yeah.
Linda Johnson, I think this is for Michael. One of my tools or philosophies or whatever you want to call it is not to worry about things that might happen, but they might not. My mother was a terrible worrier. She was always thinking about, "Oh, this could go wrong, that could go wrong, what will I do if such and such?" And she made herself an embroidery thing that she hung on the wall, and I have it now in my house, that says, "Today is the tomorrow that you worried about yesterday, and all is well."
Thank you.
I hope no one takes this the wrong way, but I find humor helpful. When my sister was passing, and then when we were planning her funeral, my now boyfriend, who was a platonic friend at the time, made a point of sending me a joke every day so that I would at least have one smile, one laugh every day. And that really helped me through the process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Humor's great. Thanks. Okay. Oh, there is one more there.
I really liked, Pat Embers, I really liked what you said that the students said yesterday about when they were asked how they overcame, you know, their loss, and this wasn't the answer. It was living through that. And I think those of us, there are more than just us that have lost children. You know, that's, and even though it's been 30 years, That's the key, I think, in terms of, you know, concentrating on getting through, overcome. You don't overcome that. And that's not a negative thing. You remember, you write journal poems, whatever, that you pull out of the box later on or whatever. And it's just something that you find all these ways, you look for all these ways to get through that, because it really never goes away. So it is something that you get through, And I think those are pretty key words that those kids said.
Okay, I'll invite us to take a few moments now for some meditation as I share with you again these words from Mason Bolton. Breathe. For yourself. For each other. Let us breathe in when others cannot. When we can do nothing else. Let us stretch ourselves open to embrace our friends. Extend our bodies outward to anyone willing to meet us, and even those we think may not be willing. Let us hold each other for the moment, for this moment. For this blink of human existence. We'll join now in singing hymn number 100, I've Got Peace Like a River. I leave you with the words of feminist and social justice activist L.R. Nost.
Do not be dismayed by the brokenness of the world. All things break, and all things can be mended. Not with time, as they say, but with intention. So go, love intentionally, extravagantly, unconditionally. The broken world waits in darkness for the light that is you. Amen.